Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Sam Fenwick. Coming up on the programme, two major economic meetings are taking place today. In Russia, global leaders, including President Putin, Xi Jinping and Narendra Modi, are gathering to discuss their trading relationships. Meanwhile, on the other side of the world, in Washington, economic superpowers are focusing on rising debt levels. We'll explore how these discussions could affect your daily life. Also today,
the concern about Trump is, starting tomorrow, you can't do this, we're not going to buy this. We think that if he's having a bad day, he might do something that will really end people's agricultural career.
How might the US election change lives for Canadian farmers?
And we'll be live in Scotland's biggest city, Glasgow, which has confirmed it will host a smaller, scaled-back, more economical edition of the Commonwealth Games in 2026. The Australian state of Victoria was due to host those games, but had to pull out due to spiralling costs.
That's all to come here on World Business Report in the next 30 minutes. Let's start today in the western Russian city of Kazan, where leaders from 32 countries are meeting for the annual BRICS summit. Students there waving flags, chanting welcome and cheering as Xi Jinping's motorcade passes by. This club of powerful nations has teamed up to achieve common economic goals. It began 18 years ago with Brazil, Russia, India and China. In 2010, South Africa joined, and most recently, on January 1st, Egypt, Ethiopia, Iran, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates were welcomed in. They hold regular meetings to discuss trade, investment and development, aiming to create what they believe is a more balanced global economy and reduced reliance on Western financial systems. China is the largest economy in the group, so how influential is it? Joining me now is Kerry Allen, the BBC's China media analyst. Kerry, thanks for coming on World Business Report. Given the underwhelming Chinese GDP figures that came out last week, is BRICS a good distraction for China at the moment?
It absolutely is. It's an opportunity for China and Chinese media to really amplify the message that that China is this powerful country that can work with others with a goal of friendship and bringing countries together. And there's a lot of messaging on this in Chinese media, an emphasis that leaders from all these different countries, developing countries, are coming together and they're doing something positive. They're boosting each other's economies. And what they're also doing, newspapers, is they're drawing a parallel between what they see at the moment of scenes of devastation in areas like Gaza and Lebanon and Ukraine. And they're saying, well, this is, you know, the US is very much involved in militarizing regions like this and causing devastation. This is what these newspapers are saying. Whereas countries like China and Russia, India, they're coming together and they're trying to look at opportunities to boost developing countries and to unite countries that maybe aren't as powerful as countries like the US.
Kerry, stay there. Let's delve a little bit deeper into China and what China gets out of BRICS. Earlier, I spoke to Dr. Yu Jia, a senior research fellow at Chatham House. It's an international affairs think tank. It's based in London. And I asked her about the extent of Beijing's influence within BRICS.
The newly joined members, such as Iran, Ethiopia and Egypt, they all have a very close ties, both economically and politically, with China. And these are the candidates in the past very much favored by the Chinese to let them join the organization.
Really? So you think it was China that was the instrumental in these countries joining BRICS?
China is instrumental, but I think also with the support among many other members, with the exception of India.
China is also a main trading partner and investment partner for all of these BRICS nations.
BRICS is not only an economic union, but BRICS is also a political entity that many of those countries are non-Western and would prefer to have a platform to discuss about the world. We should really consider China's role within the BRICS, both in economic terms, but also in the political terms.
Is it fair to say that China probably holds more power now that Russia is at war with Ukraine and has isolated itself off even further from Europe and the United States?
It's very hard to judge at this stage. I mean, while we're talking about BRICS, another very significant member in here is India. And obviously, both Beijing and New Delhi had a quite a difficult relationship in the past few years. Part of the reason why the BRICS wasn't as successful as it was intended, precisely because of the very difficult relationship between India and China.
I mean, where does that sit there now?
Both China and India would like to declare themselves as being the largest country and leader of global South. But obviously, China has already been in that position, whilst India is catching up. But also because of India's close strategic tie with the United States these days, being perceived by Beijing as some sense of anti-China player in here.
So it could be a bit frosty over the next few days between those two nations.
So judging from the rhetoric beforehand from New Delhi, I think Beijing and New Delhi just struck a deal on the border issue, which is one of the key disputes between the two countries in the last few years. Beijing and New Delhi showed some willingness to reset their bilateral relationship.
There are other arguments, though, aren't there, between members of the BRICS original countries and the BRICS plus countries, the new countries that have joined. One of those issues that is dividing them is whether they reduce reliance on the dollar.
Indeed, I think the BRICS and the BRICS Plus and would like to create a sense of monetary union that is able to exchange their currency without intervention of US dollars. However, I think the difficulties in here is that all of those countries have some kind of trade surplus with the United States and also settle their trade payment in the dollar terms. So that sense of the exorbitant privilege of US dollars won't go away.
So 24 countries have been invited to join this summit. Russia and China hope that they will too join the BRICS Plus movement. But how likely is it to happen?
Well, I think this is likely to happen to definitely shifting away. But I think what we should consider is we should consider this as being another option that those non-Western countries together have a platform, an extra platform beyond the G20, beyond G7, to discuss international affairs, to discuss global economy. So I think the importance in here is less of the substance, but more of the signaling to show that global South, developing economies are extremely relevant.
What do you think will be the best result for China coming out of this by the weekend?
Having two new additional members to be included, Thailand and Malaysia. And secondly, have some kind of soft and initial nascent stage of kind of monetary mechanism without US dollars.
Dr. Yu there from Chatham House. Carrie Allen from the BBC is still with us. We talked there about what China might want out of it. You mentioned before we heard from Dr. Yu about the poor GDP figures. What might people, how might these meetings affect people in China? How might it affect daily life?
Well, it may encourage people from other countries to enter China more and do more trade in the country. And a major concern that the Chinese government has is its labour market is shrinking, and that's a consequence of the one-child policy, which was abolished in 2016. But it means that there's a much younger working demographic, and the older demographic are increasingly retiring. So China has a crisis now where a lot of younger people are having to work excessive overtime to fill in behind the labour market. So initiatives like BRICS and other ones as well that China's involved in, like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, they encourage countries to work more closely. They encourage trade into the country, more mobility from people from overseas. And there's the hope that that will prop up China's labour market, that it will mean China's more connected.
And when you look across what the state media are putting out today, do you get that message? Is that message getting through to people?
Well, there's a real emphasis. Chinese media like to look on the positives. So they're really talking about the increased membership of BRICS and really talking about the positivity of lots of countries working more closely with the bloc. Much as Dr. Yu said, the emphasis on new members joining. And there's really a drumming up of momentum of more countries recognizing this and China rising as a power. So a real emphasis on this and a suggestion that with more countries working with China and moving away from US systems, things like the dollar, that this is a positive force for the world.
Kerry Allen, thank you very much for joining us today on World Business Report. We're going to be talking a lot about BRICS over the coming few days. How do you think the BRICS nations influence the global economy, and what impact do you see on your country and daily life? We'd like to hear from you. You can contact us on WhatsApp, or you can send us a voice note, +44 330 678 3033. We would really like to hear your thoughts. With the upcoming US election looming, its impact will be felt far beyond American borders. Nowhere more so than in Canada, the US's largest trading partner and closest neighbours. But how is Canada bracing for the potential changes? The BBC's Megan Lawton reports now from Ontario. She's exploring how the election results could ripple through Canadian livelihoods and industries.
For some, in the quiet Canadian border city of St. Catharines, November's US election is something they're thinking about.
I would want Kamala to win because she is pro-immigration, so it would definitely impact me.
Divashi has been living in Canada for 6 years.
Because I'm still not permanent residence yet. I'm trying to be, but there's a lot of hurdles for us who are trying to legally move in. And it might just get harder if Trump wins and then if Canada follows suit with, the US.
Turn left onto Valley. Leaving the city, which is around 20 kilometres from the US border, we head to rural Ontario. It's Canada's second largest province, which accounts for over a quarter of Canada's farms. In the small town of Puslinch, we stop by Dave Braden's beef farm.
How are you?
Brilliant to meet you. Let me come here.
For farmers like Dave, the election outcome presents a threat to livelihoods.
It's going to be harder for me because they may pass a law that says I'm not allowed to say what's in my meat or what's not allowed in it.
Which means he's watching the polls closely.
I think with Kamala, we have the assumption that she will recognize those values. The values of, first of all, honestly talking about a subject. A concern about Trump is, starting tomorrow, you can't do this, we're not going to buy this. We think that if he's having a bad day, he might do something that will really end people's agricultural career automatically. And that's so threatening.
Not everyone agrees. Another Ontario farmer who told us he's supporting Trump didn't want to speak on record.
The Republicans are very quiet here because it's not a popular position to be in, particularly since Trump is the candidate.
American Georgianne Burke has lived in Canada for 37 years with dual citizenship. She runs the Canada chapter of Republicans Overseas.
It does really matter who the president is and who's running the government. And I think that it's going to be very important that Donald Trump's priorities are to make the U.S. a safe, secure, prosperous, productive country, which will impact us tremendously because they're our major trading partner.
Laura Dawson is an international trade specialist and executive director of the Future Borders Coalition.
77% of Canadian exports go to the United States. So if the terms of trade change with the U.S., Canada feels real and immediate shockwaves. That's the main issue that is motivating Canada and its Team Canada approach.
The government minister running that Team Canada approach, Francois Champagne, Minister of Innovation, Science and Industry.
In many ways, today, when you're looking at supply chain, it becomes kind of a national security issue. When you're talking about who's going to manufacture the semiconductors, which is the DNA of progress, that is also national security. When you're talking who's going to get access to these critical minerals, when you have a country, which is your neighbor, which has all the critical minerals to power the economy of the 21st century, that's national security.
How often are you checking the polls to see who is ahead and who you might be dealing with when it comes to January?
I'd like to say almost every hour of every day, because this is such a valued relationship. Obviously, we need to make sure that we address any issues that come, But at the same time, making sure that we put our best foot forward and making sure that we engage Canadians, because we're all in this together.
With so much at stake, it won't just be Minister Champagne keeping a close eye on this election, but many other Canadians too.
That was Megan Lawton reporting for us.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
You're listening to World Business Report from the BBC World Service with me, Sam Fenwick. We're going to head to Washington now, where the second of two major economic meetings is underway. The International Monetary Fund's report on global financial stability is being discussed. However, while the IMF members are celebrating a slowdown in inflation and low market volatility, the festivities are somewhat overshadowed by concerns about rising levels of private and government debt and geopolitical and economic uncertainty. Here's Tobias Adrian, financial counsellor for the IMF, speaking just a few moments ago.
So in the report, we're showing two measures that are computed not at the fund, but by other institutions. One on geopolitical uncertainty, the other one on economic uncertainty, and those continue to be relatively elevated. So there's a kind of wedge in between the financial market implied volatility and the assessment of political or economic uncertainty. And so this tension worries us. It gives rise to the potential for a sharp readjustment of financial conditions.
So I'm joined now by Fiona Sincotta, a senior market analyst at City Index. You've been watching this press conference. I believe it's still going on, Fiona. I mean, what are your first instincts from what you've heard so far?
Yes, you know, so I think there is this concern that we have been focusing our attention towards now more recently is these high debt levels that have been highlighted by the IMF. Now, these high debt levels are coming at a time where we're also seeing sort of, you know, changes in the economic outlook and also, you know, changes in monetary policy globally as well. So it's all tying into quite a complex outlook, I think, for global economies.
And two of the largest powers, the US and China, they seem to be driving a lot of that global debt. China's government recently pumped funds into their economy in an effort to try and support weak growth. Why is the IMF so concerned about it? Why is it bad news for the economy?
Yeah, so I mean, we've been concerned, I think, about sort of, you know, China's high debt levels for quite some time now. Obviously, high debt levels can lead to falling confidence. It can threaten stability. Obviously, you've got high repayment costs that can put pressure on public finances. And also, it just means that countries such as China, who do have high debt levels, have less ability to provide support in a shock or a crisis. So I think that's where the concerns are stemming from.
And the IMF also saying that this level of debt could amplify adverse shocks. So could that level, is what they're trying to say there, that if you have this level of debt, then it could lead to more economic shock down the road?
Exactly. And that, you know, it sort of also completely sort of goes against why you're even doing the input of extra funds to start with. You know, the idea that you want to be able to jumpstart growth. But if you have extremely high debt levels, then actually you could cause quite the opposite problem. Rather than jumpstarting growth, you could actually result in an economic shock or an economic crisis.
This isn't anything particularly new. We've been hearing about concerns about high levels of debt for a good couple of years, haven't we? I mean, since the pandemic, really.
Yes. I mean, you know, and if we think back to the pandemic, there was a very large amount of spending that was obviously sort of, you know, what we would consider almost a major black swan event and required a lot of support from various governments across the globe to hold up their economies. But that's you know, we're out of that now. We're moving into a different era. And I think it's very key, and something the IMF are really sort of homing in on, is that you need to then be able to get that back under control. You know, in case there is another event like this as well, you need to be prepared in order to be able to address any additional crisis or shocks.
Well, Fiona Sinclair, thank you very, very much for that. Well, today, Hyundai Motor India made a landmark entry into the stock market with a record-breaking $3.3 billion IPO, marking the largest in India's history. Despite shares falling about 7.2% during trading, it still emerged as the fifth most valuable car maker in the country. Let's talk to the BBC's business correspondent in Delhi, Archana Shukna, about this. So take us through the numbers. A bit of an up and down day.
Oh, well, yes, it was a lackluster debut for Hyundai in the Indian markets. They opened in the red, closed in the red, over 6% down. It was overall market sentiment and investor in, expectation that kind of played a role. But this performance was expected. Even when we look at how the IPO book was built, it was largely oversubscribed by institutional investors, and retail investors had stayed away. There has been a concern about the expensive valuation, and investors have been worried, especially retail ones, that they would not be able to make gains on the listing.
Is that why?
In fact, a Bloomberg report had said that.
Sorry, I shouldn't interrupt you. I just wondered, is that why the share price fell by such a lot, because it was oversubscribed?
So it was oversubscribed by institutional investors, but the book for retail investors was only subscribed by half. And there has been very little, a response from the retail investors for Hyundai stock, at least in the current market sentiment, where they feel that the stock price and the listing price was way too expensive for the company. And add to that, the money, the proceeds that would be coming from the IPO is not coming to the Indian company. It is a secondary offer for sale. So the entire money would go to the South Korean parent company, and they've divested about 17.5%. So that also played on the minds of the investors.
I understand. Okay. And what will they do with the money that they've raised?
So, like I said, it's a secondary offer for sale. So the money is going to the South Korean parent arm, and none of the proceeds, in fact, come to the Indian entity. The South Korean company says they would be investing that for better development overall of the of Hyundai for their global plans.
And electric cars, I think they're looking at that as well. Well, thank you very much for explaining that to us, Archana. Let's go back to Fiona. It's quite interesting how that happens with IPOs. It tends to be a bit of a theme that some of them feel like they're overvalued.
Yes, we do have. We have seen that. And I think it depends as well a lot of on how the situation is in the broader market at that time. You also have, yeah, as you said, you know, a sense that a particular company may be undervalued or overvalued. And that can differ between institutional and retail as well. So sometimes it can be a bit of potluck.
Thank you very much, Fiona Sinclair, there for joining us. Now, in an ongoing story which the BBC has been following, the former CEO of the fashion chain Abercrombie & Fitch and his British partner have been arrested in the United States and are facing sex trafficking charges. The FBI opened an investigation last year after the BBC revealed claims that Mike Jeffries and his partner sexually exploited and abused men at events they hosted in their New York residences and in hotels around the world. Lawyers for Mr. Jeffries and Mr. Smith have been approached for comment. They have previously strongly denied any wrongdoing by both men. We're expecting the FBI to hold a press conference very soon. You'll be able to hear the latest on that across the BBC World Service, and also join the late edition of World Business Report for an update on that story. We're going to head now to the Scottish city of Glasgow, because it's going to host the 2026 Commonwealth Games. Glasgow stepped in to host the Games after the Australian state of Victoria pulled out due to rising costs. The event is thought to be a lot smaller than previous games, with some high-profile sports like hockey and badminton and squash not playing a part at all. Our reporter Gideon Long is in Glasgow for us today. He's been following today's announcement. Gideon, thanks for coming on the programme. First of all, tell us why Victoria pulled out of running the games in 2026.
Well, really, Sam, Victoria was one more victim of the cost of living crisis. When it first bid for the Games, the budget it set aside was around $1.7 billion. By the time it pulled out of hosting them last year, that had risen to $4 billion, so over twice as much. And the state governor, Daniel Andrews, said at the time that they just couldn't justify spending that much money on the Games.
Why did the price go up so much? Did they just not account correctly in the first place?
I think they didn't account correctly in the first place. There were then rises in the costs of materials over the intervening years. And it was a very ambitious project. They were going to try and host the Games over several different cities. And so in the end, they had to pull out because they said it would just cost too much. And after that, the Commonwealth Games Federation was looking for an alternative. It approached various cities and eventually Glasgow put its hand up.
And it's going to be, as you've been finding out today, a much smaller event than it has been previously.
It is. So the budget for this Games is around $150 million. So that's about a tenth of the budget that was targeted for Victoria. It's going to be a much smaller Games. There will be no athletes' village, for example. The athletes will be staying in hotels, and only 10 sports, which is down on previous cases. As you said, some of the traditional sports have been dropped. Among the various people we heard today from here in Glasgow was Katie Sadlier. She's the chief executive of the Commonwealth Games Federation.
I recognise that it is disappointing for international federations and athletes. All our sports are really important to us. Every time you run a different Games, you have a different makeup of sports that are on the programme. This is a compact programme, and it's been necessitated in terms of the timeframe that we have to develop a world-class event. We've been working with the international federations. This is definitely not a precedent in terms of which sports will be on the programme in the future. This Games is really very much about a resetting and reframing of the Games for the future. One of the aims of what we've been trying to do is to take about 60% of the costs out of the Games from the past so that many countries around the Commonwealth can actually run a Games.
Katie Sadlier there, who we heard from earlier today here in Glasgow. So it's a bittersweet moment, really. I mean, not many people are accentuating the positive and saying it's great that the Commonwealth Games are back on track. But I was speaking to some of the athletes, for example. They're relieved that they're going to be competing here, but they also have friends and colleagues from other disciplines, other sports like diving, for like hockey, badminton, and those sports have been dropped from the Games.
Gideon Long in Glasgow, thank you very much for joining us. That's all we have time for today on World Business Report. As I said earlier in the programme, though, we're going to be reporting on the BRICS Summit all this week on the programme, and we'd like to hear from you. How do you think the BRICS nations influence the global economy? And what impact do you see in your country and your daily life? Please get in touch. The number is +44 330 678 3033. Thanks for listening today.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.